Welcome to Weekend Ag Matters from the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network. Join us for an in-depth look at Iowa agriculture. Here are your hosts, Dustin Hoffman and Anna Haster.
Well, welcome again to another edition of Weekend Ag Matters on the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network. I'm Dustin Hoffman alongside Anna Hastert. And Anna, how are you doing this week?
Oh, man, Dustin, I am glad that it is time for the weekend. It has been a very busy Friday here at the network.
Yeah, definitely. And some of the things we got going on right now, one of the things people may not know, the current Ag Concerns Media Group, which is some FFA students out of Clinton, Iowa, up there on the east side of the state, they're at the National FFA Convention, and that's going on right now in Indianapolis. And they're sending us back podcast reports that you can find on our website, iowaagnet.com, right under the audio tab, and we want to thank them for providing some of that coverage for us, and it's a great experience for them as they're learning how to do this job as well. But again, like you said, a busy Friday. Tom Vilsack and others were hosting a panel today in Des Moines talking about, the one thing we learned in the 2016 election was the fact that rural voters can't be counted out. And they're talking about how are any of these candidates who are running from the Democratic side right now, you know, how are they going to relate to the rural voters? And one thing they talked about is RFS. And of course, we had the big hearing in Michigan this week with the EPA. We're going to be hearing some full testimonies from Secretary Nag as well as others coming up. But let's talk about quick what you got coming up.
Yeah, so it has been brought to my attention that regional wholesalers are struggling to secure enough liquid propane to meet producers' need this fall harvest season. A farmer texted me this morning saying he had to quit harvest as he was unable to obtain enough propane to dry down the rest of his corn. So here's what we know so far as to what is being done to remedy the situation. Governor Kim Reynolds on Thursday signed a proclamation suspending hours of service regulations for commercial motor vehicles transporting propane into the state. This measure looks to increase the amount of propane coming into Iowa, which is needed, of course, as I mentioned earlier, to dry harvested crops as well as heat rural homes. So looking a little bit further into this conversation, should have more on iowaagnet.com for you here soon.
And, of course, we've been talking about trade. And some of the other places we don't always think about with Japan and China is places like Africa. And that's what you're going to be talking about. Tell us a little bit about what is coming up here in your segment.
Yeah, so here in my segment, Deputy Secretary for Agriculture Stephen Senske went to West Africa for a trade mission recently. He talks about some opportunities for U.S. agricultural products there.
U.S. Department of Agriculture officials completed their second-to-last trade mission of 2019. Several companies and organizations joined agency officials this week in West Africa. U.S. Deputy Secretary of Agriculture Stephen Senske offers more details into the trip.
It has been my great pleasure to lead this trade delegation here to West Africa. Our mission has really been twofold. One has been, of course, to unlock new trade opportunities here for U.S. agriculture in West Africa, where we're experiencing strong economic growth here, and that's driving the demand for increasing food products, and, of course, part of that is imported food and farm products. And number two is to support the administration's Prosper Africa Initiative. The Prosper Africa Initiative was launched by the U.S. administration to really see how we can engage and really enhance the prosperity and enhance two-way trade. It has three fundamental pillars to it. Number one is trade and investment. And, of course, this trade mission that we're on is in direct support of that pillar under the Prosper Africa, where we're interested in increasing the commercial ties between our countries and to promote trade and investment. A second pillar of that is, of course, a security pillar of what can we do to make sure that our countries are working together to promote security across the continent. And then the third pillar is governance. What can we do to make sure that we can have democratic governance throughout Africa? How can we improve the governance, make sure that there are good transitions to power as parties may change as a result of elections? On this mission, we have had over 40 participants from the United States that have been here on this. We've had representatives from 35 agribusiness companies selling a vast array of different farm products. We've had officials from three departments of agriculture, the directors and commissioners of North Dakota and Nebraska, and the deputy commissioner for Georgia. And we've also had representatives from five U.S. cooperator organizations. Over the last 3 days, these 40 representatives have held over 487 business-to-business meetings where they have met with buyer representatives that are from West Africa, as well as some coming as far as from Eastern Africa as well, given the interest here. Right now, and this is still early from just some of the preliminary surveying that we have done, that those 487 business-to-business meetings have generated 12-month sales that are projected to be at least $11.5 million. We expect that figure to grow, again, as there's more follow-on and we get more of the survey results, but we've been very pleased with this trade mission overall. Again, it's been a great opportunity for the U.S. Department of Agriculture to unlock some of those trade and investment opportunities to play matchmaker in between the U.S. exporter and West African importers. And it's something that we see as part of a key role in providing those trade opportunities for farmers, ranchers, and agribusiness.
Senske also speaks to opportunities for U.S. agricultural products.
It does seem like a great opportunity that we have. Obviously, here in the West African nations, we have a growing middle class, and we have rising incomes. So it provides a great opportunity for a host of food products as well as other agriculture products. Some examples here, we've had a number of U.S. livestock genetics associations and exporters that are here. And West Africa is interested in improving their livestock production, increasing their productivity, and by having access to improved genetics, of course, is one of the ways to do that. And the livestock associations have been here to test the waters, if you will, to try to see what the interest is, what the market might be, and again, that was a great opportunity. Another one is, of course, with the rising incomes, you have rising demand for some ready-to-eat food products, and we've had a number of exporters that are exporting more ready-to-eat food products as well as our meat products, our traditional products like corn and soy and wheat, and also ethanol. Here in West Africa, they are using another product as an octane enhancer rather than ethanol, and it is a product, MMT, that has some corrosive effects not only on the gas tanks and in the engines, but also has some health and environmental issues similar to what our own MTBE had in the United States. Of course, when we replaced MTBE in the United States, that created a great market for an octane enhancer like ethanol. And so we've had a number of ethanol representatives on this trip as well, exploring what those opportunities might be as well.
That was U.S. Deputy Secretary of Agriculture Stephen Senske speaking to the U.S. Department of Agriculture's recent trade mission to West Africa. Stay tuned to Week in Ag Matters for more news and information.
In Iowa, we are proud of the fact that we work hard to help feed the world. However, as we celebrate Thanksgiving in November, remember that there are people right here in Iowa who aren't sure where their next meal is coming from. Let's break it down. 1 in 9 Iowans and 1 in 7 children are facing hunger. That's 341,890 Iowans, of which 111,520 are children. The average cost of one meal in Iowa is $2.70. That means to provide meals to all who are hungry costs over $157 million a year. So please consider donating to your food banks. Money can be as great of an asset as food often is, as food banks often have more buying power through certain agencies. Help package, prepare, or deliver meals to those in need. Work within your community and state to help make sure there is funding to help those who are in need of food. In a land as bountiful as this, there's no reason for anybody to be going without food. During November Hunger Month, take time to pledge to help your fellow Iowans get the food they need. This message from the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network.
Welcome back to Weekend Ag Matters. Here's your host, Dustin Hoffman.
All
On Wednesday this week, the EPA held a listening session in Ypsilanti, Michigan, over the proposed supplemental rule to the RFS. A few folks from Iowa got to have their voices heard at the hearing, and we're going to hear their testimony right now. We start with Iowa Corn Growers Association President Jim Greif of Monticello. He talked about how the demand destruction has hurt his operation.
Hello, my name is Jim Greif, and I'm an Iowa corn farmer from Monticello, Iowa, and I currently serve as president of the Iowa Corn Growers Association. I'm also a farmer who is suffering from demand destruction at the hands of the EPA due to small refinery waivers. The proposed rule is not what was promised to farmers, biodiesel producers, and our lawmakers a mere 11 days prior to this rule's release. The language in this proposal is a trick, not a treat. Instead of restoring biofuel demand based on the number of gallons impacted, the agency now wants to rely on Department of Energy recommendations that the EPA has historically not followed. This detail matters. To put it in perspective, the initial agreement reached on October 4th would restore 1.35 billion gallons of biofuel demand in 2020. The amount is based on a three-year average of gallons actually waived. However, the EPA's proposal using DOE recommendations would restore only 770 million gallons. By following DOE suggestions rather than actual numbers, farmers may only get back half of the demand destruction that the EPA actually grants in future years. This means that 580 million gallons of biofuel demand will be waived annually that is completely unaccounted for, roughly eliminating the ethanol production capacity of the entire state of Wisconsin. In corn numbers, this means 203 million bushels of corn demand will continue to be eliminated annually. That's like eliminating all the corn acres in the entire state of Colorado. On my farm, this proposal is devastating. Not only am I impacted, but this will hurt all the corn farmers in the state of Iowa. We have enough problems piled on us with the low prices, wet weather, and ongoing trade disputes. The weather cannot be controlled, but our government should be able to step up when called upon. Right now, the trust factor with the EPA is at an all-time low, and fixing this rule as requested by Iowa Corn would help this trust be restored. I will end by saying the solution is simple. EPA must follow the law. Ensure that any reallocation of small refinery exemptions is based on actual gallons waived through the program as the law was intended, and not based on DOE recommendations that the EPA itself consistently chooses to ignore. Please follow the RFS as Congress intended and uphold the October 4th agreement. A deal is a deal. The law is the law. Just make it right. Thank you.
Also getting the chance to testify was Katie James with the Iowa Soybean Association. She talked about how the EPA's proposed supplemental rule and the demand destruction for the biofuels industry has caused unnecessary damage to the rural economy.
My name is Katie James, Public Relations Manager at the Iowa Soybean Association, where I have the privilege of serving Iowa's more than 40,000 soybean farmers. It is one of my greatest joys to work for the betterment of our state's driving industry, agriculture. Governed by an elected board of 22 volunteer soybean farmers, our organization is committed to a strong and vibrant soybean industry. I firmly believe I get to work with some of the best farmers in the world, the cream of the crop, if you will. These farmers are hardworking, compassionate, motivated, and kind. They are also the life force behind countless rural communities across the state, including the one I grew up in northwest Iowa. Farmers across my state are drowning. Farmers who I speak with often and hear about their struggles on their operations are questioning whether the bank will let them plant in a couple years, and for some, even as soon as next year. When farmers aren't doing well, rural communities suffer. When farmers can no longer afford to make purchases and do business at their local shops, small towns get closer to the verge of disappearance. Farm income is at its lowest in a decade. Farmers are making half the amount of money they were just 6 years ago, and for many, that equates to no longer breaking even. The EPA's mismanagement of small refinery exemptions is one of the primary factors influencing farmers' bottom lines. Your proposed supplemental rule claims to restore integrity to the RFS, but it does no such thing. Instead, the proposal runs counter to what President Trump, our elected officials, and biofuel supporters agreed to on the eve of the rule's rollout. The truth is, your rule will further gut the RFS, kill even more demand for soybeans and biodiesel, and shut down additional biofuel facilities. This situation is critical. The biodiesel industry and soybean farmers alike were promised 2.43 billion gallons of biodiesel be blended into the nation's fuel supply, an amount we accepted, but with the goal to increase in 2021 and beyond. We were also promised volume obligations for biodiesel are met, including an accounting for small refinery waivers based on a three-year rolling average of gallons actually waived. However, your proposed rule does not restore integrity to the RSS because it relies on inaccurate three-year averaging of Department of Energy recommendations to account for SREs. It asks farmers and biofuels producers to trust the same agencies that have gutted demand for biofuels by granting these waivers. This rhetoric was snuck into the agreement we had all previously accepted, and while your right hand was undermining the words of the president, the needs of America's farmers, and the interests of our environment, your left hand was throwing dollars at big oil companies. At least 9 biodiesel plants across the country have closed or cut production, impacting thousands of jobs. Your proposal will not help reopen biodiesel plants and get rural Americans back to work. It will likely lead to more plants shutting down. The Heartland has been saying it ever since your rule came out, and we will continue to say it until a promise is kept. A deal is a deal. Your actions are contributing to the collapse of rural America for seemingly no other reason than to bolster petroleum profits. Do better, fix what has been broken, and stay true to the words you told us earlier this month. Thank you.
And finally, we hear from Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Nagy, who said Iowa cannot afford to sit idly by and that a deal is a deal.
You know, Iowa leads the nation in biofuels production, which means that we've got a lot on the line. The renewable fuels industry accounts for more than $5.3 billion in our economy, about 3% of Iowa's GDP, $2.5 billion in household incomes, and more than 48,000 jobs. So we've got too much at stake here to sit idly by and watch EPA make reckless decisions that harm thousands of Iowa families. So each growing season presents our farmers with unique sets of challenges. For many Iowa farmers, this year has been one of the most difficult seasons that we've seen since 2009. Due to weather delays, our farmers have battled record rainfall. They've battled record flooding, and they're facing ongoing trade uncertainty as well. And now, the renewable fuels standard that is intended to protect an important market for them is being undercut by their own government. On April 14th, I took a break from touring flood-ravaged parts of southwest Iowa to join biofuels leaders at the Southwest Iowa Renewable Energy Ethanol Plant near Council Bluffs. And on that day, I said in my public comments that we believe it's time for EPA to address the threat that SREs pose to the renewable fuel standard. Over the past 2 years, EPA has granted waivers that have accounted for 2.6 billion gallons of ethanol, equaling nearly a billion bushels of corn. I think Administrator Wheeler has inherited quite a mess when it comes to this issue, but it's not too late for him to do the right thing, and I stand by those comments today. On May 31, I was back at Southwest Iowa Renewable Energy Ethanol Plant, and this time we joined with other biofuels leaders in applauding President Trump and the EPA for approving year-round access to E15, and we're all very optimistic that this would spark growth in this market. Now, that optimism quickly faded in August when EPA granted another 31 small refinery exemptions. In just 3 years, EPA had waived nearly 4 billion gallons of biofuels production, nearly double the SRE gallons justified by the Department of Energy. On October 3, our hope was restored when I was invited to participate in a call with White House officials, and we were joined by grower groups and renewable fuels industry leaders, and I was pleased to learn that a deal had been reached. And on October 4, we celebrated with EPA and with the announcement that there would be a reallocation of waived gallons on a three-year rolling average of actual exemptions. A week later, we were astonished to learn that EPA had rebuffed President Trump's commitment to Iowa's leaders and proposed a rule that offered no accountability or transparency, and it fell short of the 15-billion-gallon commitment. These rules are not merely words or numbers on paper. They have real impact on people in Iowa and across the country. Hundreds of families have been impacted by those closures, and they've been forced to make hard, life-changing decisions because of EPA's failure to uphold the president's promise. It's time that the American people hold the EPA accountable. In America's heartland, the law is the law, a deal is a deal, and 15 billion gallons means 15 billion gallons. This RVO formula does not work in the real world. It doesn't work for America's families. It doesn't work for EPA. And on behalf of the renewable fuels industry, the people of Iowa, and farmers across the Midwest, I'm asking EPA to double-check its math.
You can find more information on our coverage of this EPA listening session on iowaagnet.com. We'll be back on Weekend Ag Matters right after this. Welcome back to Weekend Ag Matters, and now, here's Ken Root.
Organic food was the only thing we ate when I was growing up in rural Oklahoma. I didn't know how trendy we were until just a few years ago, when the millennials began to request, even demand, that their food be grown without crop protection chemicals or inorganic fertilizer. I want to say, that's good. But organic production gave way to traditionally grown crops because there was demand for more food from a growing population that wanted the food at a cheaper price. On that, farmers have delivered. Millennials are now the biggest consumers of organic food, with over half buying more expensive organic produce and packaged products versus about 20% of baby boomers, my generation. Large organic growers are elated by this announcement. Here is the response to a recent survey by Lauren Batcha, the CEO of the Organic Trade Association. She says the millennial consumer and head of household is changing the landscape of our food industry. Our survey shows that millennial parents seek out organic because they are more aware of the benefits of organic and that they place a greater value on knowing how their food was grown. They are deeply committed to supporting a food system that sustains and nurtures the environment. What makes millennials relevant is the size of their sector of our population. They are 75 million strong in an age group born from 1977 to 2004. The organic industry overall is benefiting from their buying habits. Growth in organic sales has climbed by double digits for the past several years. Meanwhile, back at the office farm and factory, we have the older generation that raised them. These kids were fed homogenized milk from cows that ate GMO grain, fruits and vegetables that were sprayed with pesticides to control insects and disease, and they drank water out of a well or from the municipal water supply. If you look at them as lab rats, they're fine. The food and water they ingested did not harm their health. But now they want to go backward in time, relative to food production technology, to get a product that is not more nutritious, not more healthy, but more expensive. The American dream has been to have a large supply of food at a cheap price. We have held ourselves up as the more developed nation compared to those in Africa, Asia, and even Europe because our food was cheaper. We have now a generation that's willing to pay substantially more for what they eat if it meets their criteria. What has really made organic food take off? The millennials are getting the credit because of their demand, but I contend it is because of profitability. This seems to be the strongest force behind the larger food companies who are part of the Organic Trade Association. For years, small organic farmers have been rewarded with above retail prices for their products grown in a local and fresh environment. But the trend now is to use the USDA regulations to brand a larger volume of food as organic. To do so, it will have to be grown in a cost-effective way and transported many miles. This seems to be counter to the spirit of organic in the eyes of the consumer who buys it for its unique qualities that industrialization takes away. Marketing of organic versus conventionally grown food has always been confrontational and negative. I don't like distortion of science and logic by misleading product claims. GMO-free is the newest buzzword. It's on everything. There are only 10 crops that have been genetically modified, but thousands of products say they are non-GMO. Organic has become a well-respected branding process that now has real-world certification. That may be its downfall, as the term may become generic and just show up on a large portion of the packages in the grocery store with a higher value attached. So the next generation to raise children, the millennials, may face an interesting dynamic of spending more for food and having less money to buy other things. However, there is a new generation of politicians saying, don't worry, the government will buy everything for you. Perhaps the government will require that only organic foods can be purchased with SNAP dollars. Who knows what distortions the government could cause in the marketplace? For their sake, let's pray the millennials become rich so they can continue their current preferences after their aging parents are gone. I'm Ken Root on the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network.
Thank you, Ken, and that's all for this edition of Weekend Ag Matters. We thank you for tuning in with us here on the Iowa Agribusiness Radio Network. You can find replays of this show as well as all of our other content online at iowaagnet.com. Don't forget to find us on Twitter and Facebook at Iowa Ag Radio. On behalf of myself, Anna Hastert, and Ken Root, we thank you for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on Weekend Ag Matters.